Ryby English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Claire Mosley, the founder of Care for Calais, said, "Targeting vulnerable asylum seekers is an act of extreme cowardice. UK government must support people seeking asylum to integrate into our communities rather than putting them in places like Napier barracks or large hotels." We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Diane Taylor and Mark Townsend. The piece is titled "UK Home Office Records 70 Racist Incidents by Far Right at Asylum Accommodation." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a Freedom of Information response obtained by The Guardian, the UK Home Office has recorded 70 racist incidents by far-right supporters against asylum seekers in barracks and hotel accommodation. However, campaigners supporting asylum seekers in such accommodation say the figure is a significant underestimation of the true picture. The data, which covers 1st of January 2020 until 13th of July this year, involves incidents in the much-maligned Napier and Penally barracks, which have been under intense scrutiny by MPs after their untenable conditions were revealed, as well as a large-scale COVID outbreak in the former. Penally barracks in Pembrokeshire, Wales, was closed in March, despite only being opened in September of 2020, along with Napier in Folkestone, Kent. Hotels have been used throughout the period, but their use for asylum seekers increased sharply after the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020. In Napier barracks, 4 incidents were recorded between September and December of 2020, with 12 occurring so far this year. This is despite the barracks being temporarily emptied in April after the coronavirus outbreak. There are now thought to be 176 asylum seekers living there. Several incidents at Penally Barracks was reported to the Home Office last year, and many in 2021. Witness statements from legal challengers by asylum seekers living there reveal a catalogue of disturbing episodes, including an attempt to ram a refugee with a car. Others include stones and bottles being thrown, rape threats, attempts to start fights, fireworks shot through the gate, and eggings. According to witness statements, a farm shop in the area said some of the far-right supporters had asked to buy pigeon scarers to mimic the sound of gunfire and frighten asylum seekers. The number of incidents recorded in hotels has tripled this year, with 40 examples reported, up from 13 last year. On Saturday, 7th of August, the far-right organisation Britain First posted a video on its website headlined "Britain First Exposes an Illegal Immigrant Hotel in Hull," in which members of the organisation say they posed as journalists to confront asylum seekers. One asylum seeker from Yemen experienced two incidents involving far-right protesters at his Home Office-provided hotel on the outskirts of London. He said, "They were driving around the hotel recording us on video," adding, "They were insulting us, swearing at us, and screaming things like, 'Go out from our country. Why are you eating our food? Go away from us. You are strangers here.' We were too scared to go outside the hotel and felt like it was a prison. We had to stay inside." He added, "We fled countries where there is war and destruction and felt safe when we arrived here. But when we saw this kind of racist attack, we felt we were not protected." Maddie Harris of Humans for Rights Network said, "Ghettoizing people seeking safety in large-scale accommodation such as hotels and army barracks exposes them to harm. The figures shown here are not an accurate representation of the level of racial abuse endured by the people we support. We have had numerous conversations with asylum seekers where they have told us how unsafe they feel due to frequent incidents of racial abuse and that they have experienced in and around these accommodations." Claire Mosley, the founder of Care for Calais, said, "Targeting vulnerable asylum seekers is an act of extreme cowardice. Our government must support people seeking asylum to integrate into our communities rather than putting them in places like Napier barracks or large hotels." A Home Office spokesperson said, "It is unacceptable for anyone in asylum accommodation to experience hostile or racist incidents, and we ensure each incident is thoroughly investigated. We work closely with a range of organizations to ensure immediate support and assistance is provided to people living in the accommodation, and if needed, escalate to law enforcement." Meanwhile, European citizens who have applied for settled status are being detained and threatened with deportation, a development that contradicts assurances from ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. The Home Office has served European Union nationals with removal directions, even though they could prove they had applied for settled status, which should protect their rights to remain in the United Kingdom. Ministers have repeatedly promised that anyone who had applied by the 30th of June deadline would have their existing rights protected while their case was being heard. The apparent failure to honour the agreement has prompted accusations of either administrative incompetence by the Home Office officials or a willful attempt to deport as many European Union nationals as possible, on the assumption they're easier to remove, for instance, than asylum seekers. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to the head of Immigration Enforcement, dated 29th of July, raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge receipt of settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport European Union citizens. Bail for Immigration Detainees says that unless a meaningful response is received from the Home Office, it will make an official complaint to the European Commission. Lawyers argue it marks an important battle to protect the rights of European Union nationals following Brexit. They warn that the failure to acknowledge applications could potentially affect thousands of individuals. Recently, an EU citizen from the Home Office wanted to deport and who had been detained in an immigration removal centre, secured their release on bail after a judge accepted that they could not be removed because they had made an European Union settlement scheme application. Even so, the Home Office still contested their release and offered no apology or explanation why it had earlier argued there was no evidence of the application at a previous hearing and therefore could deport them. Speaking shortly after being released, the European Union national who requested anonymity told The Observer, "They're trying to play with mine and my family's lives and it's not fair. I'm supposed to have rights." Pierre McLouf, legal director of Bail for Immigration Detainees, said, "It seems that the Home Office has pre-decided the fate of certain European Union nationals, perhaps believing that they're easy to remove. But in its drive to deport more people, it is sidestepping legal requirements and legal procedures." The issue appears to relate mostly to applications sent by post instead of being forwarded digitally. Aranea Kogolathos, a barrister and legal manager of BID's EEA, European Economic Area project, said paper applications were used by many vulnerable and marginalized people, including the elderly and those in detention or prison, who found it difficult to access computer or didn't have access to a valid identity document. The numbers affected could be significant. For instance, out of 1,500 inmates at Wandsworth Prison in South London, almost 500 are believed to be European Union nationals. Barrister Aranea Kogolathos said, "Despite having made the European Union settlement scheme applications, European Economic Area nationals are being deprived of their liberty and even served with removal directions, both of which they are forced to challenge despite limited access to legal advice and legal representation."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The President of the Democratic Republic of Congo has authorized United States Special Forces to enter the country and ostensibly help the Congolese army battle ADF rebels, reportedly linked to Daesh terrorist group. Now, Kambale Musavuli, a DRC human rights activist, says ADF are being used as a pretext for U.S. forces to enter his country.
We know in DRC that this is just a pretext to have military presence in the DRC that's continuous. The ADF for us is our weapons of mass destruction. Never been found. We do not know what they do. Yet, it's always a pretext for military presence.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an alternative view on events taking place in Africa. Today, we are focusing on the move by the United States to send its special forces to the Democratic Republic of Congo under the pretext of fighting the ADF rebel group. We are examining the real reasons behind U.S. military deployment to this mineral-rich country. In the second segment of our program, we are analyzing the digital divide in Africa and how it's impacting negatively on the continent. Stay with us till the end of our show.
U.S. troops in mineral-rich Democratic Republic of Congo. On the night of August 13, 2021, a U.S. Special Forces team arrived in Kinshasa, the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The alleged objective of this deployment goal is to fight the invisible and fabricated ISIS-Daesh terrorist group. Washington claims the ADF terrorist group, originally from Uganda, is affiliated to ISIS. However, multiple reports, including the UN group of experts, have categorically rejected that any ties exist in the DRC between ISIS terrorist group and rebels known as the Allied Democratic Forces, or the ADF.
The President of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Felix Tshisekedi, has authorized U.S. Special Forces deployment in his country. Now, this decision is in contrast with two former presidents, Laurent Desire Kabila and Joseph Kabila, who resisted attempts by the U.S. to deploy its forces in the country. During his speech at the recent session of the General Assembly of the United Nations, President Tshisekedi said his country has joined a U.S.-led coalition that claims to fight terrorism.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has joined the Global Coalition Against Terrorism as the 24th member. My country is delighted with the decision taken by the coalition's meeting in Rome on the 20th of June to set up within it a working group on terrorism in Africa.
Now, this announcement by Tshisekedi is seen as signaling a major shift in his country's foreign policy, and this might help the U.S. topple China's dominance as Kinshasa's preferred trading partner. Now, to discuss more about the growing U.S. influence in the DRC, we have contacted Carl Gachebuke, the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, our first question, can you tell us why the Democratic Republic of Congo is unable to effectively combat rebel movements in the East?
One is that the DRC military itself is corrupt. It's made up of a mix of former rebels who were involved in destabilizing the Congo in the first place, people who are who should be facing charges for war crimes and crimes against humanity, but now they're part of the official DRC military. The other part is the destabilizing factor coming from neighboring countries, especially Uganda and Rwanda. Rwanda specifically having been a major destabilizing force, which is Rwanda and Uganda both supported by the US and the UK and now France. The third is that there's so many international organizations, multinationals, and even governments that fuel the conflict in the Congo.
Thanks for that, Mr. Claude Gachebuke.
UN experts said in June that they had not found conclusive evidence of ISIS or Daesh command and control over ADF operations. By ignoring the UN report and explicitly linking the region's militants to ISIS, the US is transforming Eastern Congo into a new front in a so-called war on terror. Of course, ADF rebels continue to operate like many other rebel groups in Eastern DRC, which have caused suffering to civilians. A victim here speaks out.
Cesare, ule vile baribani yaka banamufunga, musikiyani.
The U.S. claims its special forces are in the DRC to combat ISIS or Daesh-linked ADF rebels, while the U.N. says this group has no links to Daesh. So what's really behind U.S. deployment of troops to the DRC?
Really, what it is a pretext for the U.S. to send to officially and openly send their troops into the Congo by claiming that there's a group tied with ISIS. Really what's behind it is, you know, the U.S. has been at trade wars with China for a long time. And at the end of the day, you know, what the U.S. troops are doing in the Congo is not so much to fight Islamic forces and ISIS in the Congo. It's actually to secure U.S. interest in the Congo, to ensure that they have a force to protect U.S. interest in the Congo.
Well, Felix Tshisekedi, the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, has called for a review of mining contracts signed with China in 2008 by his predecessor, saying he wanted to get fairer deals. Now, Mr. Getebuke, you earlier mentioned that the United States is increasing its military forces in the DRC to counter China. Can you elaborate more on that?
The U.S.-China trade wars are, it's a global trade war. And Congo is an important part of, you know, the global economy in so many ways. And, you know, the minerals coming out of the Congo, you know, are, I mean, they fuel so many different things. The uranium, the coltan, the gold, you know, so many minerals coming out of the Congo are, you know, fuel the global economy. And today, I'm convinced that the reason the U.S. is there, and especially with, you know, the renegotiating of the China mining contracts being, you know, announced, is for the U.S. to secure some of these mines. It's an extension of the trade wars. What's happening in the Congo right now, the deployment of these U.S. troops in the Congo, considering these mining contracts, is an extension of the global trade wars between the West and China, and specifically the U.S. and China.
On the 17th of January 1961, 60 years ago, Patrice Lumumba, the first legally elected prime minister of the DRC, was assassinated after being overthrown with the help from Washington. A Congolese citizen here speaks on the anti-colonial legacy of Patrice Lumumba and how current leaders have betrayed this legacy.
Yeah, the left us a great legacy. That is working for the people and avoiding influence from Western countries. But we see since the Second Republic, our country is still being dominated by foreign powers.
The United States, through a spy agency, the CIA, assassinated Patrice Lumumba, who was a Congolese independence and revolutionary leader. Having this in mind, what's the opinion of the Congolese people regarding increased U.S. military presence in their country?
Many, many Congolese people, especially a lot of the people who are, you know, who study and analyze the region and study and analyze the Congo, are extremely concerned, and they have cautioned everybody about the presence of U.S. and other foreign troops in the Congo. So it's mixed. Mostly those who are well-informed are against the presence of U.S. military in the Congo, and generally.
The presence of rebels committing atrocities in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo raises questions about the functionality of the United Nations Stabilization Mission in the DRC, known by its French acronym, MONUSCO. This is UN's largest peacekeeping operation with 20,000 troops on the ground for the past 20 years. However, these UN troops have been unable to eliminate the rebels. Locals are now protesting the ineffectiveness of the UN forces.
We denounce the ineffectiveness of the UN force MONUSCO, which has an offensive mission, but which for years has failed to do anything. MONUSCO must either act or pack up. We want to mobilize the national and international opinion in the face of this tragedy.
Now, the United Nations peacekeeping force in the Eastern DRC has failed to stop attacks on civilians. Why is such a large force unable to fulfill its mandate?
These UN troops are actually, in fact, many of them taking a part in the looting, you know, stealing of resources in the Congo, literally. You know, some of them are like smuggling and selling gold and other minerals. Some of them have been caught committing violence and sexual violence against the Congolese women. UN forces, where instead of carrying out the mission of protecting civilians, they actually are doing harm to the civilians. So it's a shame that so much money has been spent, so many troops are in the Congo, and they are not protecting civilians.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Agatabuke, for your analysis. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is about how the digital divide is slowing literacy in Africa. Stay with us.
Digital divide slowing literacy in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
A report issued during this year's International Literacy Day has revealed that lack of access to computers and electricity is impacting negatively on literacy across Africa amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
The report by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, titled Literacy for a Human-Centered Recovery, Narrowing the Digital Divide, notes that in sub-Saharan Africa, only 7.7% were estimated to have a computer at home, while household internet access in the region is still limited with a rate of approximately 22%.
Now, despite the grim situation, there are efforts by organizations such as UNESCO to provide schools with internet access and computers. A teacher in the remote region of northern Kenya explains here how internet access has changed learning.
Internet has been a game changer, even in the performance and even the grades of our students here in school. So now many of them, because they can learn on their own, they can discover things on their own, their attitude has changed greatly. When they have the tablets, the learning becomes more interesting because there are different ways of accessing the same information.
Now to discuss how lack of access to computers and internet is affecting literacy levels in Africa and possible solutions to this problem, we have contacted Julius Mbaluto, a London-based African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time.
It's a pleasure.
Now, Mr. Mbaluto, in your opinion, how serious is the digital divide in Africa and its impact on literacy?
Africa has got a very huge population. The population of Africa is like very youthful, a lot of them, and also they love technology. Most of them are techno-safi, but the governments have not managed to successfully bridge that gap of technology divide. So when you look into the West, most of these countries in the West, they are extremely covered well in terms of connectivity, whether we talk in terms of internet, accessibility, and also in terms of even affordability, which means like it's easier for a lot more people in the West to afford a laptop or even iPad or even a computer. But it isn't the same story for Africa, because in Africa, most of the time, then it's a question of affordability.
Thanks for having Julius Mbaluto, African Affairs Analyst.
Most African governments must step up investment in information communication technology or ICT infrastructure to help students and employees work and study from home in this era of COVID-19 and beyond. Have African governments failed in their duties to bridge the digital divide, especially during this COVID-19 pandemic?
A huge population of schools whether university, whether primary or even secondary, they didn't have the technology to enabling them to learn at home. And also in terms of lack of that technology means even some schools don't even have the computers that can even help them to do the same. So it's just a few that can manage that. So if you look into a country with challenges of technology and connectivity, indeed is a question of governance. It's a question of a government probably never really provided the infrastructure in schools to make sure schools can function efficiently no matter what season of life comes.
UNESCO says the pandemic and its repercussions have also magnified the pre-existing inequalities in access to meaningful literacy learning opportunities, disproportionately affecting 773 million non-literate young people and adults, mostly in Africa. A South African student says remote learning at home came with lots of challenges.
Remote learning was very difficult for me because we didn't have internet and the school taught us through WhatsApp. Since my mother was not working at the time, I was constantly worried that she could not afford data so that I could do my work.
What short-term and long-term steps are needed to remove the existing disparities in access to internet across Africa?
In terms of technology, it's about time Africa begins to focus on being self-reliant. And when you look into capabilities, if you go again to Kenya, the youthful generation of Kenya devised the most advanced system in the world for money transfer, known as M-Pesa. That one, even the West cannot reach that level. And you can see now when given the chance, when youth's potential has been actually exploited, how far Africa can go. So it's about Africa, time for Africa to begin to look for solutions to the problems that Africa is facing. And also without shy, government have to invest in these technologies.
While most developed countries move their classes online with ease, many developing countries have been found wanting due to a lack of infrastructure and the high cost of gadgets to access the internet, such as laptops, computers, and smartphones.
Now, in a move towards self-reliance in IT gadgets, Kenya recently opened Africa's first nanotechnology and semiconductors factory. Now, the country's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, speaks here during the official opening of the factory.
We are already from here, the first African country. We're selling microprocessors. We're selling to the United States now. We're selling to France. We're selling to Japan from Kenya. This is going to be the future for us to be able to now make our own motherboards, and from making our own motherboards to making our own television sets, to making our own mobile telephones. These are all new opportunities that are all going to be created from this seemingly very small but very critical foundation towards our manufacturing agenda for our republic. So I thank you, and I take this opportunity also to thank Deren Kimathi University, and I want to thank them for also being visionary, not being difficult, allowing to give these young entrepreneurs seeking to come home, to bring their knowledge home, to give them space, to allow them to work with members of your staff, to enable them to engage with your students. Asante sana. This would not have happened without your support. So, Bwana Kioni, Vice Chancellor, Hongera Kwako, na viongozi wote wa Dedan Kimathi University.
Importation of gadgets such as computers and mobile phones has made these tools inaccessible to millions of poor students in Africa. Now, how can this challenge be solved?
We have all, across Africa, we have all these professors who have studied in the West in terms of technology. We have very capable people in terms of technologies and importation. Why not begin again to make our own computers? There's nothing wrong with that. You can make our own computers in Africa. if we again we harness all this, and it's just not a country to country thing. Yeah, I think this should be like a clarion call for African Union to bring countries together, to look, you know, bring all the potentials, like potential, harness that potential of experts across Africa, depending on whichever country it is, just identify them, begin to like, what can you do for your country? Can you start a plan? Can you begin to give back to society? And this hub, can it be a hub for manufacturing computers, laptops? Even if you start in a very small scale way, one day it's gonna grow, one day it's gonna be big.
Now, while access to technology is critical in improving literacy, especially during the current pandemic, are African countries ready to have their own internet ecosystem to avoid digital colonialism and over-reliance on Western countries?
I want to address every country in Africa that claims and loves what they call sovereignty. I value that. Sovereignty is one of the most important things. But without your own internet, seriously, you're exposed. That's what I want to say. Simply put, you're exposed. The one controlling the technologies can see everything, every your plan, every bit of your tomorrow, every bit of your vision. They see through it. And therefore, you are not free. And therefore, I am advocating African internet for African countries, and also as systems that each country can protect itself, even in terms of security, and actually manage to control everything, every aspect of life in that country in a way that a foreign nation cannot interfere, cannot change, cannot violate security, cannot do anything. That's what sovereignty is about, being independent, being in control of your destiny, being able to control your systems, having your own system that cannot be violated even by interferences of the West. That's the key thing for Africa.
Well, Mr. Mbaluto there says that for Africa to be truly independent, it needs to have its own internet infrastructure to avoid digital colonialism. Well, that's all the time we had for this edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Do drop us a line through our social media handle and send us your comments. God bless you.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
New research appears to confirm what Black Lives Matter activists and abolitionist organizers have said for years. There is a crisis of police perpetrated killings in the United States that has gone underreported for decades, and people of color and black people especially are most at risk. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mike Ludwig, journalist. This article is published under the heading, New Study Shows More Than Half of U.S. Police Killings Have Gone Uncounted Since 1980. Stay tuned for more. research appears to confirm what Black Lives Matter activists and abolitionist organizers have said for years. There is a crisis of police-perpetrated killings in the United States that has gone underreported for decades, and people of color and black people especially are most at risk. Deadly police violence has long been a major public health crisis, but an estimated 17,000 deaths from police violence were misclassified in federal public health data over the past four decades, according to a new study published by a team of researchers in The Lancet, a leading medical journal. The study found that black people are 3.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white people, and Latinx and indigenous people are also killed at disproportionate rates. The study also suggests that local sheriffs, coroners, medical examiners, and police themselves may play a role in skewing federal fatality data that obfuscates the severity of the police violence crisis. According to the team's calculations, 55.5% of deaths caused by police were not reported as such between 1980 and 2018, including nearly 60% of cases where the victim was black. It's incredibly naive to assume that it is all just by happenstance, that it is just by coincidence, and that they are listed under another cause of death, said Amara Enia, police and research coordinator for the movement for Black Lives, in an interview. The findings bolstered the movement to disarm, defund, and even abolish the police that grew out of uprisings that followed the high-profile killings of unarmed black people in recent years, from Eric Garner and Michael Brown in 2014 to George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others in 2020. Nationally, this study found that rates of deadly police violence and racial disparities within them have remained stable since 1990 or increased despite reform efforts. Activists have long argued that police reform has never prevented police killings, and the public resources afforded to police departments should be reinvested in disadvantaged communities and public health approaches to safety. Police violence has created simmering tensions in communities of color for decades, if not centuries, but the issue often flies under the radar in the national conversation until a particularly egregious killing sparks an uprising. Along with the persistent racism within the U.S. legal system and media, the new research suggests that the systematic underreporting of deaths caused by police and suppression of quality public health data may be partially to blame. Unfortunately, you have these headline cases that tend to put more of a spotlight on these deep systematic issues that we face, issues that have been attempts to call attention to, but for numerous reasons, they don't gain traction until you get, for example, the murder of George Floyd or Mike Brown for another number of reasons, Enia said. Conduct the study, a team of researchers compared three independent databases that track more recent police killings with the National Vital Statistics System, the Federal Database of Births and Deaths, and used data analysis to project discrepancies between the independent and government data back in time. Nonprofits and newsrooms began tracking police killings after the death of Brown and Garner, and journalists have noted for years the gaps between their data and what authorities report. The study draws on previous research to explain the massive gap between the actual number of people killed by police and the number of deaths officially attributed to police violence. In many cases, a medical examiner or coroner simply fails to mention police involvement on a death certificate, or the death was incorrectly coded when entered into the federal data set. There are substantial conflicts of interest within the system for investigating and recording deaths, the authors write, including the fact that many medical examiners and coroners work for or are embedded within police departments. In 2011, 22% of respondents in a national survey of medical examiners reported that they face pressure from an elected official or appointee to change the cause or manner of death on a death certificate. The study also acknowledges that policing and the criminal legal system in the U.S. has a long history of anti-black racism, and like black revolts of the past, police at all levels of government were called to put down the uprisings and protests of 2020 by force. If half of the cases are going unaccounted for, that minimizes the scope and severity of police killings in this country, and I think that tracks with a lot of narratives that came out last year that attempt to minimize the significance of George Floyd or Breonna Taylor and reduce them to individual unfortunate cases, Enya said. For example, former President Donald Trump attempted to downplay the uprisings against police last summer by claiming that more white people are killed by police than black people. With this statement, Trump essentially manipulated data to push his preferred narrative. A larger number of white people are killed by police because there is a larger population of white people in the U.S., but studies show that black people are shot and killed by police at twice the rate of whites. The racial disparity is even more pronounced in cases where the victim was unarmed and posted a minimal threat to police. There are multiple systems at play that can perpetuate certain narratives or make sure that certain narratives don't get the light of the day because they are in collaboration with each other in one way to put it, Enya said. Enya also noted that the manipulation of data to fit certain narratives about crime and violence have parallels in the media, where journalists often report claims made by police departments as fact without determining whether these claims are true. These narratives built on manipulated information and faulty data, including the systematic underreporting of deaths caused by police violence, directly shape public perception and policy making. Enya said, if those numbers are accounted for, it can change the narrative in a way that pushes for the kind of systematic changes that the movement for Black Lives and so many other people who came out into the streets last year have been pushing for.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
For a time too long, Lebanon has been mired in a deep economic crisis. The World Bank says Lebanon's current crisis is possibly among the top three worst crises the world has seen in 150 years. Here is a list of numbers. The currency has lost over 90% of its value since 2019. 78% of the population is estimated to be living in poverty, and 36% are grappling with extreme poverty. Experts put the fault on economic mismanagement and corruption. Also to blame are foreign interventions and sanctions imposed by the United States and its allies to punish Lebanon for the influence the resistance movement Hezbollah enjoys in the country's political structure. Chronic political instability in Lebanon has further exacerbated the crisis. Add to this the devastating explosion at the port of Beirut that inflicted billions of dollars of damage. The situation has led to severe shortages of medicine and fuel and power cuts. The United Nations has sounded the alarm over the dire economic situation and rising hunger in Lebanon.
The situation remains a living nightmare for ordinary people, causing unspeakable suffering and distress for the most vulnerable. Starvation has become a growing reality for thousands of people.
Fortunately, the Lebanese have been hearing some good news for a while. Iran has started exporting fuel to ease the energy crisis. So far, several shipments of fuel have entered the Arab country under a deal arranged by Hezbollah, which has called this a break of the American siege. And last month, a new government was finally appointed, ending 13 months of political wrangling. Earlier this week, Lebanon restarted discussions with the International Monetary Fund after a more than a year-long hiatus to arrange a loan. And now, Iran is assuring the Arab nation of its full support. The Iranian top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdollahian has visited Lebanon, saying Tehran is ready to help with development projects in the Arab nation. Specifically, he said Iran is ready to build two power plants in Lebanon and help rebuild Beirut's port. And Lebanese officials have welcomed this. In a meeting with Amir Abdollahian, President Michel Aoun commended Iran's support for Lebanon and the measures the Islamic Republic has taken to help the nation overcome serious challenges. All this raises hope of better days for crisis-hit Lebanon.
A family saga spanning some 20 years. Dubai's autocratic ruler Sheikh Mohammed Al Maktoum and his ex-wife, Jordan's princess Haya, fighting over the custody of their two daughters in UK courts. The UK High Court has ruled that during a crucial phase of the hearings, Al Maktoum ordered the phones of his former wife, her personal assistant, her security and legal team, and that of her barrister, who is a member of the House of Lords of the British Parliament, to be hacked. Princess Haya fled Dubai 2 years ago, after she learned of her husband's abduction and mistreatment of their two daughters. In the UK, she applied for court orders to prevent her children from being returned to Dubai.
The judgment that was handed down in the court behind me revealed how Dubai's 70-year-old ruler, a close ally of the UK, abused his power and breached UK criminal law in order to snoop on his wife and the people around her.
The intrusive spyware used, Pegasus, developed by the Israeli regime's NSO group, touted as one for fighting terrorism.
What we see here is confirmation of what has been suspected for many months, at the very least, in terms of this particular software to combat terrorism, but then being abused to further personal vendettas.
It was the same spyware that the Sheikh's henchmen used to track down one of his daughters, Sheikha Latifa, in 2018, when she tried to flee Dubai on a boat.
When a head of a friendly state is without authority, breaking the law in the United Kingdom in such a blatant way, and even threatening his own family. For example, we've seen in the past, of course, where he's alleged, with quite considerable evidence, to have even kidnapped his own daughters, kidnapped from, effectively, the United Kingdom. That did not prevent these close ties from remaining, perhaps even being reinforced.
The UAE is home to more than 500 British businesses and more than 120,000 Britons. It's a UK-made weapons client. Sheikh Mohammed Maktoum is a billionaire racehorse owner with strong ties with the British establishment. He also owns a property empire in the UK. He's been photographed with the Queen and, above all, has sovereign immunity from any future possible prosecutions. But UK law has been broken here, and this case poses extremely awkward questions about one of Britain's closest friends in the Middle East. If campaigners say where money is involved, the British establishment is prepared to look the other way. Saeed Pourreza, London.
It The United Nations Human Rights Council has voted against renewing the body's mandate for investigating possible war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Members narrowly voted to reject a motion brought by countries including the Netherlands and Canada to give UN investigators another 2 years to monitor atrocities in Yemen. It marked the first time in the Council's 15-year history that a resolution was defeated. Ahead of the vote, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said there was no peace in sight in Yemen and that urgent funding was needed to avert large-scale famine there. Meanwhile, the Dutch ambassador called the vote a major setback, adding that the Council failed the Yemeni people and cut their lifeline to the international community. Rights activists had previously warned that Riyadh was heavily lobbying against the resolution in a blatant attempt to ensure blanket impunity for crimes and other violations of international law in Yemen. They also accused the UNHRC of bowing to Saudi pressure and putting politics before principle. Experts believe the Council has lost its credibility by shutting down the investigation.
UN Human Rights Council has lost any credibility it once had, and that was marginal anyway. But by shutting down an investigation into atrocities committed in Yemen, this is something that is clear to anybody that horrendous things are happening in Yemen. And the fact that some other countries have strong-armed those council members to vote against this is just politics, but it's corruption, and it's tragic for the people of Yemen.
This is not the first time Saudi Arabia has used what many call arm twisting to stop the UN from scrutinizing the Yemen war. Back in 2016, Saudi Arabia was removed from the UN's list of children's rights violators after Riyadh threatened to cut off crucial funding to the world body. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has claimed tens of thousands of lives and displaced millions, resulting in what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The coalition, which is logistically and militarily supported by the West, especially the US and the UK, has repeatedly bombed schools, hospitals, and other civilian facilities during its 7-year onslaught. The United Nations has in the past been criticized for its inaction against Riyadh, but the latest move by the Human Rights Council seems like giving a green light to Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies to continue their atrocities against impoverished Yemen with impunity.
From the yellow vests to the longest general strike the country has ever seen, France under President Emmanuel Macron has been the site of constant grassroots expression, but also shocking political repression. For the first time since the coronavirus epidemic began, France's unions called a nationwide strike, with protests taking place in over 200 cities and towns. Unions and workers are accusing politicians and bosses of manipulating the corona crisis in order to ram through more far-right economic austerity measures. Deeply unpopular cuts to unemployment insurance take effect this week, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty.
The government has used a pretext of health concerns to cut wages, to cut government jobs, to reduce worker rights, and to allow bad working conditions to get even worse. It's great to see everyone from workers to students to pensioners back in the streets again, because these cuts to unemployment are unacceptable during these tough times.
A decade of failed austerity, followed by the unprecedented corona recession, has given France's lower and middle classes a list of problems too long to fully mention. Inflation, energy prices, intense corona-related restrictions on personal freedom, unemployment, soaring inequality. But perhaps most telling is that even conservative politicians now talk of the need to, quote, make work pay, because French wages and salaries have been so stagnant for so long.
La vie a augmenté à tous les niveaux.
The cost of living does nothing but increase, and in seemingly every possible way. Costs are even higher than when the yellow vests first began, but we haven't been allowed to demonstrate. Until salaries are increased, things will continue to be more and more difficult for the French.
Protesters say that the coronavirus lockdowns and work cutbacks are too often presented as some sort of welcome and generously subsidized vacation. The reality is they have been catastrophic for many average households. The French street is alive with protest for the first time in over 1.5 years, and it may decide the outcome of Macron's re-election bid this April. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.